Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. That's the one and only super producer, Mr. Max Williams. Woo! Give it up for him. My name is Ben. Noel, I want to thank you in advance for doing this episode because birds.
Well, not only birds, Ben, the most terrifying of all of God's hideously deformed winged creatures. The one what walks on the land and comes at you with its long snake-like gangly neck and beady little eyes. You know, it's got the strength to like smash a car window with its face. I mean, well, these are the most terrifying creatures on Earth. These and the emus. Well, that's fair. There's also that one, what is it, the cassowary? It's basically like the velociraptor of the bird family. They can like, like disembowel a man with its one razor sharp claw.
Yeah, I actually have a soft spot for ostriches and emus as well, but shoebills, cassowary, those things freak me out. I'm glad to, as a lover of all animals, I don't mess with them. Just shoebills always look like they're up to something.
Remind me what a shoebill is. That's the one with the really big, flat, freaky beak, right?
Yeah, yeah. They always look like they're going,
Oh God, you're Ben. The moment you said that, I Googled the picture and the very first image, it looks like he's going, it is I, the shoebill, come to wreck your day.
I know. It's like they're always saying, are you sure about that?
He looks like he'd be friends with the Grinch.
Dude, yes, there's what I'm looking at right now. He looks downright sinister. Like he is, you know, he's got those kind of Ninja Turtle creases between his eyes, you know, like the furrowed brow. And I'm not talking about the, you know, Saturday morning cartoon Ninja Turtles. I'm talking about like the darker, creepier early comic version. And it's just a staring daggers right into my soul. I fear the shoebill stork more so than the ostrich, but the ostrich is damn terrifying. But also turns out it produces some pretty fluffy, delightful, and dare I say precious to certain types, plumes.
Segue. That's right. Today's episode is about one of the largest and most profitable industries in the world in the 20th century, around the turn of the 20th century, really. It was something called millinery, the art specifically of decorating women's hats with bird feathers. And you're talking about like all the high rollers in Europe, in the US, and everywhere in between, if you were a fashionable lady, you had to have not one, but ideally a collection of hats that were just awash, festooned with bird plumage, sometimes with like whole stuffed birds, right?
Like literally wearing like a tiny taxidermied chickadee on your head.
Mm-hmm. To let people know that you had it made.
You say lavish. I think the word I would choose to use would be garish, but whatever. Different times, different strokes and all that. It's true. I mean, we think of the cliche ladies hat, you know, of bygone eras. And we do think very ostentatious, very large and in charge and covered in these kind of plumes. Very, very ornate. We also know, of course, the era of the hat pin and the ladies that armed themselves with these very long, scary hat pins to fend off the notorious masher of, I believe that was around, what, the 1920s?
Yeah, early 1900s, which is interesting because this would have been happening around the same time. So do check out our hat pin story if you haven't heard that episode before. Big question. Just like people are concerned with supply chains nowadays, the big question was this: where do we get these fancy feathers? Some of the most popular ones came from herons and egrets that live in the southeastern United States. Mm-hmm. But these had limited availability. You couldn't get them year round. You could only get them during the breeding season. And for the rest of the year, when you couldn't get your heron feathers, you had another option, the ostrich.
But eventually it became more than an option. It became literally the most sought after of all the bird plumes in question here. By around 1910, the ostrich trade was the most lucrative industry in the country of South Africa, where they were farm raising these birds specifically for their feathers. And obviously we know that they would also be surely used for their meat. I mean, ostrich jerky is a thing. I think there are some restaurants where you can get like ostrich steak. It's apparently a little bit like a dark meat that almost like sort of splits the difference between like a steak vibe and like a, you know, dark meat chicken vibe.
Yeah, yeah. I've actually, I've had ostrich meat before, jerky, as you mentioned. And then I want to say there was a place I went to called Fossil Farms. They sell ostrich steaks. Now, be warned, they're a little bit pricey. We're talking about $16 or so for an 8-ounce steak. But I don't regret it. I don't know if it would be an everyday thing for me, though. You know, it's kind of like kangaroo, I guess. But aside from our carnivorous tendencies, maybe we should learn a little bit more about the ostrich, because I'll be honest, I was watching a lot of videos before I even knew we were going to do this episode. I was watching a lot of videos of this lady who like rescues ostriches, and she has this farm with these different ostriches, and they're temperamental creatures.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You could also sub in the word terrifying creatures, but let's dive in ever so slightly, if we must, to the history of ostriches and the role that they ultimately came to play in the fashion industry. Atlas Obscura, as always, has a fantastic article on today's topic, The Strange Tale of the Great 1911 Trans-Saharan Ostrich Heist. Is that the name of a prog rock band, you might ask? No, it's not. It's the topic of today's episode, but we're getting there. And this one is by Vincent Gabriel. And in this article, Vincent goes through some of the history that we're about to talk about. Arnie Moores, who is a professor of biodiversity at Simon Fraser University, who is quoted in this piece, has this to say. The ostrich may be the most evolutionarily isolated species in the world. What do we mean by that, Ben? Evolutionarily isolated. They've got some things that one would think would cause them to not thrive, but yet here they are.
Yeah, yeah. It's the ostrich is one of those animals that when you see it for the first time, especially in real life, your first thought is, really? Really, though? Like, how? How and why?
Why, God? Yeah. Why?
The spooky thing about these farm videos is that when the ostriches are in a good mood and they're affectionate with their trainer, their handler, or whatever, they kind of, like, loop their neck around your shoulder.
No, thank you.
Or no, they go, like, they put their head and their neck into the collar of your shirt and kind of snuggle up. I know. Please don't. I know. No. I'm getting uncomfortable talking about.
Stay away.
But they're so, you're right. They are, when we say evolutionarily isolated, what we mean is that ostriches and their closest relatives, cassowaries, kiwis, emus, stuff like that, they actually diverged when dinosaurs were still walking the earth. And according to Morse, they're different because they have a long evolutionary branch with a flowering at the very end. Just two species, couple of subspecies, Central and Southern Africa. And since they were around when humans got on the scene, human beings have had a lot of time with these massive, weird-looking, but beautiful birds. And they've been traditionally hunted for meat. You can make leather with their skin. Mm-hmm. They even feature in like Egyptian iconography.
Not to mention that they sport, maybe that's not quite the best choice of words, but I'll go with it. They sport the largest eggs of any living member of the avian family, which is kind of interesting. And so therefore they are also hunted for their eggs because like one ostrich egg is like the equivalent of like a dozen chicken eggs, you know, in terms of the amount of juice that it produces.
I think one ostrich egg alone has like 2,000 calories. So it's a family meal, I think. But if you have eaten an ostrich egg by yourself, kind of want to hear the story.
Well, your picture goes on the wall, my friend. Let me tell you.
You get a t-shirt and you get a hat with plumes on it. Uh-huh. There we go. So we know these eggs, I'm glad you brought this up, because these eggs have been used for many purposes, many flexes throughout various civilizations. They were carved up and like given as offerings in ancient Grecian times. And I believe later they were used to decorate minarets, as is mentioned in that Atlas Obscura article. So how did we get from there to this hat craze? Like we said, there was sort of an arms race for elaborate hats in the world of fashion in like the late 19th and early 20th century or so. And these hats got bigger and bigger and bigger, and ostrich feathers became a natural fit because ostrich feathers are also really big, right? So you don't want to have a ginormous hat and then have some dinky like little sparrow feather corsage on there. People are going to tell you that you have a plain hat, which is a big insult back then.
God, plain hat?
Get out of town.
You are not a member of this country club, my friend. Absolutely not. So here's another thing evolutionarily that is very interesting. Because these massive birds, you know, take up a lot of space on the earth that would normally be freed up if they were like, you know, flighted birds. These feathers that normally are adapted to creating the means for flying now have become more of a tool for elaborate mating ritual displays, you know, similar to the peacock. People talk about peacocking around. No one really says ostriching around, but it's a similar deal. They display these feathers, you know, and some flighted birds do as well, if I'm not mistaken, but it becomes much more important because they're, you know, approaching a potential mate and they have to kind of do this little dance or whatever. So the feathers that would typically be used for flight are much more tightly constructed. They're kind of knitted together in this asymmetrical kind of pattern. Ostrich feathers, on the other hand, are very long and they're loose and light and they have these fluffy little plumes, you know. When you think of the word plume, I think a lot of us think of like a writing quill, you know, or like one of those cute pens that like teenage girls like with the fuzzy ends on them or whatever. You know, two very different sized writing tools from history, but both equally plumey. Also, the word plume refers to like a puff of smoke, something very wispy and like, you know, stretched out that kind of has this sort of like ethereal quality to it, right?
Yeah, yeah, well, that's a great description. Also, these feathers don't have the tiny hooked barbs that are on other feathers from other animals. So it's the perfect fit for decorating the hats of these wealthy members of society. And these hats were a huge, huge deal from like the 1800s all the way to the advent of World War One, or I should say the outbreak of World War One in 1914. One person is quoted in a great Daily Kos article by Lenny Flink, just says the following. It says, "A well-dressed woman nowadays is as fluffy as a downy bird fresh from the nest. If you would be fashionable, you would be beplumed." Now, I want to say beplumed more often.
Beplumed. I like that, Ben. That suits you. Try that one on. See how it goes. So this was the height of fashion, and the beauty of it was, you know how like most fashion trends are cyclical or seasonal at the very least, right? Not so with the ostrich feathers. They were absolutely at the height of popularity and fashion all year round.
Yeah, exactly. And just as fashion also kind of trickles down over time and becomes less exclusive, the same thing happened with ostrich feathers. Eventually, there were at least 14 different varieties, numerous kind of grades of feather, which meant that you didn't have to be a one percenter to get these. And the transatlantic ostrich feather, according to CJNews.com, was mainly in the hands of a lot of Yiddish-speaking immigrants from the Russian Empire. This was an international thing. This was an international trade. People were working in South Africa, the Middle East, Europe, the United States. But as we already said, the heart of the ostrich trade was there in South Africa, and that's where the feather trade originated. And generally, the hunters, the people who actually got these ostriches, were indigenous inhabitants or folks who had settled there from Europe. Even if you really like ostriches, you got to be careful with them. They do have a heck of a kick. They can injure you. They can kill you. There is one thing I wanted to ask you guys about, because in the research, we found some claims that ostriches have been domesticated, but I don't know if I quite agree with that, because they seem like they could be tamed, but they still seem very much like wild animals, right?
I don't know, man. I'd show me a tame ostrich. I just don't think they have it in them. You know, they're like dinosaurs.
I think this is a challenge. I mean, should we try to domesticate an ostrich?
The Fennec Fox experiment would argue that it's possible. When that,
y'all can have that one. I'll be the third party observer from afar. You can send me like just YouTube updates or whatever, and I'll like give you my two cents, since I am the height of skeptical about this. But go with God, gentlemen. Go with God.
They're only partially domesticated, apparently. And according to ThoughtCo.com, they're only domesticated for a short period of their lives. So maybe we can be the ones to change that.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hi, I'm David Eagleman from the podcast Inner Cosmos, which is now nominated for the best science podcast in the nation. I'm a neuroscientist at Stanford University, and I've spent my career exploring the 3-pound universe in our heads. I've recently kicked off my second season with a whole new batch of questions like, why do we sleep and dream? Can you measure a lie in the brain? What needs to happen for you to actually be declared dead? What is memory? Why can't you tickle yourself? Why is it so hard to keep a secret? Can you skip school to just upload information directly to the brain? I'm hitting these questions and hundreds more because the more we know about what's running under the hood, the better we can steer our lives. So join me weekly to explore the relationship between your brain and your life by digging into unexpected questions. Listen to Inner Cosmos with David Eagleman on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. I hope to see you there.
But to get a better picture of this, let's just say there was so much money involved that people were willing to risk injury or possibly death because the trade was so popular that feather handlers could maybe pluck an ostrich, an adult ostrich, every 8 months or so. And they would also grow alfalfa as like the livestock feed. And if a farmer did this, alfalfa and ostriching, I like it. If they did this, they would earn like 5 to 6 times more in a year than they would have if they were just regular farmers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it's worth the premium for dealing with devil spawn year round like that. I wish them the best. But, you know, okay, listen, I kid, obviously not a fan of these creatures, but these were not particularly pleasant circumstances for these ostriches, were they? Were they like plucking them and then is that a one-time thing? You pluck them and then no, it's not, right? You pluck them, what did it say, yearly or how often?
Every 8 months,
so close to a year. And I can't imagine that's a pleasant experience for the bird. It's not like getting shaved if you're a sheep. I mean, they're like ripping these out to keep them intact, right?
Yeah, it's clearly they're plucking them based on the farmers or handlers are prioritizing the highest quality feathers, right? Mm-hmm. Ideally, because that's going to have the biggest profit margin. But I don't think it is particularly pleasant for the birds, especially if you just do a quick internet search in your browser choice for plucked ostrich. It doesn't look like they had a good time becoming that way. You can see the little bristles and spines and the skin, which, trigger warning, might set some people off.
Oh, God. Yeah, I wish I'd waited for that trigger warning.
Next time, we'll put it in the front. Oh, this is terrifying. Yeah.
They look like plucked chickens, literally. And they're mainly, this is not okay.
Why did I look that up after you looked it up, Noel?
And they look even more like dinosaurs now, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And something about the color of the skin and the texture just really.
It's very unsettling. It's very unsettling. And yet we all probably had turkey for Thanksgiving dinner. So
right.
Maybe we should rethink our own values here. But so as we said, I mean, this is a big business for South Africa. At the time, they provided around 85% of the entire planet's ostrich feathers. The rest came from, as you mentioned earlier, Ben, from North Africa. And there were these established trans-Saharan trade routes that were typically navigated on the backs of camels. Mm. So this was just fine for South Africa. Ostrich feathers were its third most profitable export, and the government had already taken over land from some of the indigenous people from the surrounding areas, not to mention Dutch Boer settlers, and ousted them from their land. And they used that land to create these massive ostrich farms that were overseen by the government.
Yeah. Yeah. This gives rise to things like Oudtshoorn, which is a feather town. So feather towns were a thing. But there was one big problem, and not everybody outside of South Africa was aware of this, or not everybody outside the African continent. South Africa was selling feathers like gangbusters, but they didn't actually have the best feathers. everybody in South Africa in the trade knew there was something else. There was a better kind of ostrich, the Barbary ostrich.
See, and that's the thing, Ben. I mean, if you don't know what you're missing, I'm sure these South African feathers were great, you know, and then they were, you know, plenty fluffy, and the inherent nature of the ostrich feather in and of itself is going to feel really great if you get one. But when you compare it to the extra snuggly, extra plumy Barbary ostrich feather, these South African ostrich feathers looked like trash in comparison. And we were starting to see shipments of these feathers passing through. So people were starting to get hip to the fact that they were missing something, that there were better feathers out there.
Yes, better feathers indeed. That's because the Barbary ostrich is the largest of all the subspecies, making it the largest living bird, meaning that those feathers are going to be larger as well. And they were also, they also had this quality called being double flossed. They had a kind of filmy down, if you can picture it, that was much more dense in comparison to regular old South African ostrich feathers. And so this made a tremendous and luxurious or garish display that people were super into. By 1882, by the way, a single pound of ostrich feathers, just the regular ones, were going for about $400, which is a little more than $10,000 today or so.
Jeez Louise. And just for a reference, today you can get two ostrich fillets for $17.98 from wildfork.com.
You go, I mean, to Wild, you know, Fork, I go to Fossil Farms. We gotta switch. Let's try them out.
I think we should, Ben. And it's crazy, see, when you look at these ostrich fillets, they really do look straight up like steak. And I think that largely has to do with the fact that they're such active and lean birds, you know? So it's it really does like have the appearance of a steak. So the South Africans looked at this as an opportunity. They were not daunted. I mean, they already owned, you know, 85% of the global ostrich trade, ostrich feather trade. So they're like, well, why not just, let's diversify. Let's figure out where these massive, you know, high quality feather yielding beasts come from and get our hands on a breeding pair of them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a brilliant plan, right? We will get the top-notch quality feathers, and then we won't have to worry about this American competition out there in Arizona. One problem, though, nobody really knew where the Barbary ostrich came from. And so they saw an opportunity, an ostrich-tunity, if you will. I make no apologies, Max. The thing is, by the time they got all these, the top-notch feathers, they had been passed through so many middlemen that nobody knew the origin point. The best guess the experts could make in South Africa was that these birds must be located somewhere in the lower edge of the Great Saharan Desert, within a place called the Sahel region, and that's within caravan range, like you said, Noel, by Camelback. It's caravan range of the trading center at Tripoli. And so, 1911, the South African government officially organizes a Trans-Saharan ostrich expedition. The entire reason this thing is around is to hunt down Barbary ostriches and bring back as many as possible alive to South Africa.
And let's just be clear here, aka steal them.
Oh yeah, it's a heist. Yeah.
Yeah. It's absolutely a government sanctioned ostrich heist. That's what we're dealing with. Yeah, exactly. After all these years, after all those Ocean's 11 movies, but the heist is on. A guy named Russell William Thornton, who was a hero from a conflict called the Boer War, was assigned to lead the expedition. And this guy already had experience in the ostrich farming industry. So Russell Thornton's goal, his charge that was bestowed upon him by the government, was to make his way into French Sudan, find the ostriches, and get a flock back to South Africa, should he choose to accept it, which he definitely did choose to accept it. This would have been before such a time as the Americans or French officials got wise to their movements.
Yeah, exactly. They made some pretty hurried preparations, And Thornton said, all right, I'm going to round up a couple of my boys who are ostrich experts. And then he brought what to me sounds like a small army, around 100 porters, trappers, cooks, translators. They get together, they get on a boat, they sail from Cape Town in August of 1911. And the reason they were so rushed was because they were worried that somebody else might beat them in the heist. Thornton's own brother, Ernest, this guy had been an expert ostrich rancher, but he went to the dark side. He quit his job with the government and left for the United States. And then people were worried he had become a turncoat and sold his, become a consultant to help guide some Americans into the African continent and find the Barbary ostriches first. Why is this not a film? I feel like I say that once a month, but this is great.
So our guy here, our fearless leader, Russell William Thornton, before going back to South Africa, he on the side explained to his brother, who was along with him, that he was actually a double agent.
Dum dum.
I mean, seriously, this keeps getting weirder. He was a double agent and he was working as an independent contractor spying on the American ostrich industry. Later, he sort of walked this back a little bit and claimed that his whole intentions were to force the South African government to act on the information, the intel that they got as to the whereabouts of the Barbary ostrich. South African officials were not happy, understandably, with the way he behaved, you know, when he was supposed to be their guy on the ground, you know, in the trenches, in the dunes.
This is where we learn the phrase ostrich espionage or ostrich espionage. Ostrich espionage. Yeah.
I'll take it. I'll take it all. Give it to me.
So we learned this phrase thanks to the work of a biologist with a cool name, Thor Hansen. Thor Hansen wrote a book called Feathers, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle, which talks through this story. And Thor says, even now, in the modern day, it's still unclear who was spying on whom and how true or untrue Ernest Thornton's story about being a double agent was. But still, Russell only found out about this double agent thing after they were already on the boat. So they were already on the way. And I think it took them several months, right? Eventually, they got to British Nigeria.
So at this point, Thornton's crew, which, would hopefully have contained at least one bagman, were camped near a town called Kano, like the character in Mortal Kombat with the laser eye who rips your heart out and holds it up and it's still beating because that's totally how hearts work. And this is in British Nigeria. Where was Kano meant to be from? He was South African, I believe.
You know, that's a good question. Let's see. Kano, Mortal Kombat, nationality. We're just going to do this live, folks, because I'm not sure. He is an Australian. He is from the Earth Realm.
Earth Realm, Australian. Got it. And for some reason, I thought he was in the movie. They made him South African for some reason. But, those don't say this to an Australian or a South African, but those accents do tend to get muddled up for me sometimes.
Shots fired.
Nope. Shots retracted. Shots retracted. No shots intended. But yeah, so they're camped out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they know that this trading center, Kano, like you pointed out, this trading center sells a bunch of stuff. One of the things it sells, Barbary ostrich feathers. So they know they're like trying to trace back the trade, right? And reverse engineer the process till they can find the actual birds. So Russell sends out scouting parties every possible direction you can imagine. And also he starts... Tell me what you think about this. It sounds like he was roughing up these desert caravans. Like he was, quote unquote, inspecting the cargo. It feels a lot like pretending you're customs or something.
Well, it's sort of a form of extortion or, kind of strong armory, right? But in doing this, he got some very valuable intelligence. He learned that they were getting these plumes from an area around a place called Zinder, which was, by all accounts that he had access to, the only place on Earth where wild Barbary ostriches could be found.
Yeah, and that's a problem. That's another plot twist, because this would be a great film. Xander is not just a week's worth of travel away, it's also inside a French colony, Sudan, which is now part of Niger. South Africa was considered self-governing, but it was technically part of the British Empire, and the French and the British empires didn't really get along, so Thornton felt like he had to ask his bosses for the green light. He sends a wire to South Africa and says, hey, good news, bad news. Good news, pretty sure I think we found where the ostriches are. Bad news, it's deep in French territory. So he is waiting to hear back from his bosses and from the government to get the okay to cross in there, you know, knowing that it could be an international incident.
So in the meantime, while he was waiting for a response from his government, he spent time buying up as many ostriches and these Barbary fancy plumes that he could. In 6 weeks, he got the thumbs up from the South African government to go ahead with the plan. They said that he was authorized to spend £7,000 for 150 ostriches, but it was almost like a black ops mission.
Yeah.
Right? Because they basically said, you know, should you be captured, we will disavow any knowledge of this mission or association with you.
How crazy is it that is absolutely true?
Serious business, man.
Mm-hmm. And so with this suddenly black ops mission on his mind, Russell takes his gang 150 miles north through the desert to a place called Fort Xander, and he first tries diplomacy. For 6 weeks, he's trying to get the French colonial authorities to let him have some ostriches. And this is like Dr. Seussian level ridiculous here. The French officials didn't have a clue as to why the South Africans would want these ostriches in particular. But they said, you know what? You're technically part of the English Empire. And if you want them, then we're not doing it. Because if you want them, now we want to keep them. And so they said, okay, listen here, Russell Thornton, you can't hunt these, you can't capture them, and nobody sell them any ostriches. And they're like, well, why, boss? And he's like, because they're basically British to us.
Oh, man, poor guy. So he kind of went back to British Nigeria, plumeless hat in hand. And with no creepy, gangly neck birds in tow.
He was plain-hatted. Mm-hmm. The tragedy.
That's the worst way to be. Yeah, but Thornton was a man of great resolve, and he knew that he had what it took to get this done, and he was not going to be bested by a bunch of Frenchies.
Yeah, he went to his network, the local desert leaders, and he turned to them for help. This is where the story gets a little muddy, right? I don't know how we want to film this when we finally start our film studio, but we do know Thornton somehow, eventually, does return to South Africa. He has a flock of ostriches, but there's like missing film from the narrative here, because right now, people don't know how he got these ostriches.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hi, I'm David Eagleman from the podcast Inner Cosmos, which is now nominated for the best science podcast in the nation. I'm a neuroscientist at Stanford University, and I've spent my career exploring the 3-pound universe in our heads. I've recently kicked off my second season with a whole new batch of questions like, why do we sleep and dream? Can you measure a lie in the brain? What needs to happen for you to actually be declared dead? What is memory? Why can't you tickle yourself? Why is it so hard to keep a secret? Can you skip school to just upload information directly to the brain? I'm hitting these questions and hundreds more because the more we know about what's running under the hood, the better we can steer our lives. So join me weekly to explore the relationship between your brain and your life by digging into unexpected questions. Listen to Inner Cosmos with David Eagleman on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. I hope to see you there.
What gives? Well, we have some private letters that Thornton sent back and forth between himself and a confidant by the name of Mr. Smith. And there are hints at possible extracurricular smuggling expeditions into French territory. And these were not all entirely without incident. There were even some conflicts with some nomadic tribesfolk and some French soldiers reported in these exchanges.
Yeah, at least that's what people are finding from this, as you said, these private letters. But our buddy Thor notes that the Russell's descendants deny anything like this happened. So right now, officially, we can't say it's confirmed that he rolled in and turned his heist mission into like this action-packed montage of violence. Although that's, just to be fair, what I'm picturing. But either way, he does get a flock of ostriches. Hostriches, you could say. He took them hostage and marches them from northern Nigeria to a train to take them to Lagos, right? Oh, and he gets malaria.
Ah, fun. You see, drink a little tonic water, I'll knock it right out. So the ostriches are loaded into these specially modified kind of cattle cars, you know, train cars. And then they were transferred to a freighter heading to Cape Town, South Africa. 140 of the total number survived the voyage, which is it's not awful, right? It's not right. Not terribly bad survival rate for such a, you know, what would be a pretty strenuous voyage. Thornton's team, when they got back, they were treated like kings. They were given a ticker tape parade or whatever the South African equivalent of the day was. Thornton's brother, on the other hand, after being, you know, outed as a double agent, decided to he threw in his plain hat.
His plain hat. I feel like we've invented a new thing calling people plain hatted, which is a shame because you guys know my lucky hat is very plain. And for some reason, the idea of having feathers on that bad boy just freaks
put
me
a,
out.
Put a single matchstick in it or maybe a playing card.
There we go.
Yeah.
Minimalism. Thanks, man. That's a great idea, actually. I might do that. So my terrible awkwardness and haberdashery aside, you're absolutely right. Russell Thornton's gamble is paid off. He has saved the future of South Africa's ostrich monopoly for about 2 years. Because then the final plot twist occurred. The feather market crashed. It plummeted. Ostrich feathers were no longer compared to diamonds. People had once upon a time said that a good ostrich feather was an investment for life. Kind of like the way people talk about really fancy watches. But if you look around nowadays, right? Ostrich feathers are much less of a big deal, right? Or do we just not hang out in fancy enough circles? What do you guys
think? I'm not sure, man. I know, you know, it's funny. I was actually Googling ostrich steak to see like what types of restaurants sell ostrich steak. And it is upscale. Like it's definitely considered like a delicacy. Still, like you can find it at some fancy steakhouses here around town, like Rathbun's, for example. But when I Googled that, I also noticed that the key word came up for decor as well in some fancy restaurants. So if something has like, is adorned with like ostrich feathers or, you know, used in some way to like, you know, kind of add a little pizzazz to certain interior decorating, that would also be considered very, very fancy, schmancy.
Ah, okay. That makes sense. Yeah. And despite the fact that they're still very fancy today, we're pretty sure we know what happened that spelled the end of the global ostrich trade. One of the big factors was the Audubon Society and then something called the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. They were against the mass killing of birds for hat purposes. And they have been against this for years and years and years. And because of the efforts of the Audubon Society in particular in the U.S., Uncle Sam eventually passed something called the Lacey Act, which was going to prevent the interstate trade in wild birds. Ostriches and domestic birds were technically excluded from the legislation at this point, but the writing was on the wall. The feathers were on the bird. This fashion trend was on its way out.
Right. I mean, you know, even nowadays, like with artists and makers and stuff like that, that you know, create beautiful pieces of whether clothing or home decor or whatever, it's not particularly popular to use real bird feathers unless they are humanely sourced. A good friend of mine who lives in Australia makes jewelry, and she uses humanely sourced feathers, meaning she finds them. She doesn't pluck them. These creatures are not raised to, you know, like pluck them of their feathers. She literally traipses through the forest with like a little headlamp on and looks for shed bird feathers. And then you can use those. Otherwise, it's just kind of a bad look these days, you know?
Mm-hmm. And there's another thing that happened here. The automobile came into play, right? The automobile has hit the stage. And what does that mean? That means big, fancy hats that were perfectly fine when you're walking around are no longer as practical. Like, how do you, if you're in an open carriage car, how do you keep that thing on your head? And then also, when World War I comes around, people are a little more hesitant to appear very showy or very well off because everybody is basically having a terrible time, right? And then women are going into the workforce as soldiers are sent away to foreign theaters of war. Apparently, according to that great Atlas Obscura article, Noel, you referenced early in the show, apparently the final thing, the ostrich feather that broke the camel's back, was the emergence of the bob cut. A bob cut, I think most people know, is just a really, really short hairstyle. And the theory is that this hairstyle was just not capable of supporting really cartoonishly big ass hats.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And as we know, aside from like little old ladies on Sunday, big hats are not so much a thing anymore. Well, remember that big hat that Pharrell wore for a while? Kind of like the Arby's hat.
I still don't understand that one, man. I've thought about that in the years since. What's going on? I mean, wear what makes you happy first.
He's Pharrell. Yes. Yeah. He was trying something out. He was trying to, you know, make a change in the zeitgeist single-handedly, which if anyone can do it, it's him. Don't know that it took off, but you do occasionally see big weird hats.
It's as dumb as it comes, though. It is so just like...
Like, is it a park ranger hat? It's not quite. It's like a child's drawing of a park ranger hat.
My question is, if you push down the top, does it go down or is there something in there? Is there like a support system built in there?
Oh, yeah.
Or a rabbit, perhaps, or some sort of small hairless cat.
A small ostrich.
Or a smaller hat. Or a smaller Pharrell.
Yeah, it's the Russian sacking dolls.
Russian nesting hats.
Yeah, there we go. Okay, well, we've solved it because I like all of those answers. Of course, this is not all whimsy. this was a huge trade. So thousands of people did lose their job when this industry collapsed. And that kind of spelled the end of it. But we do have an epilogue, Nolan. I think this has probably been on your mind as well. One of my big questions, Max, is probably your big question too. Nolan, what about the ostriches? These ostriches that got kidnapped, almost 150 of them, got locked up in South Africa. Are they out of jobs too, or what?
Well, we don't really know exactly what happened to them. What we do know is that they were never bred into South Africa's, you know, stock of ostriches. That just didn't happen. The last bird from that flock was a male and was killed in a lightning strike. So all of this Ocean's 11 ostrich edition heisty business was absolute waste of time and energy for all concerned.
It's a shame, you know, and the ostriches, the Barbary ostriches from that area in Zinder and Kano on the Nigerian border, unfortunately, also were not long for the world because these French colonial administrators weren't going to permit official exports, but it appears they didn't pay enough attention to the unofficial stuff, the smuggling, the overhunting, the encroachment of humans into the natural habitat. As our pal Thor Hansen says, and I love this, he says, they didn't send the brightest bulbs to Zinder.
No, they did not. And one of the sad things about all this is that I had sort of speculated early on that they would have, you know, used every part of the ostrich, or when they were, you know, retired from being plucked, they would have used their meat. But I guess you want the meat of young ostriches. I'm not quite sure. But the point is, there was this huge uptick in the, you know, use of feathers as like a trading commodity. But that did not mean that people were eating more ostrich. Instead, you had a lot of these animals that were being found in the wild, killed, plucked, and then just left to rot or be eaten by scavengers.
Oh, like the buffalo, huh?
Exactly. I mean, we were supposed to use every part of the buffalo. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to use every part of the ostrich, but no, pretty short-sighted in these situations.
Yeah, and so this leads us also to a harsh ecological lesson. Today, the Barbary ostrich has been eliminated from most of the Southern Sahara Desert. It's critically endangered. It exists in some parts of Chad, Cameroon, and Senegal. But there's a big question. Are these the same ostriches as the ones Thornton was rounding up? Or were they something else that is now extinct? And it's a tough question to ask, but it's also, I think, an appropriate sort of epilogue to the great Trans-Saharan ostrich heist.
Yeah, and we can end this one with a little bit of ostrich trivia. I think everyone's probably aware of the almost cartoony cliche notion that ostriches stick their head in the sand when they're scared. It's sort of, I don't know, I think it was always used to imply that ostriches were either stupid or cowards in some way. We know they're definitely not cowards. They will come at you and snake at you with that weird tiny head and gangly neck. But it turns out this is all just a matter of the way an ostrich looks and the proportion of its head to its body. If you're looking at an ostrich from a distance and they're like nibbling at a little bit of food on the ground, it could in fact look like their tiny little heads have disappeared into the sand.
I see. And yeah, and their heads are really, really small. We also have some more ostrich trivia. They're the fastest two-legged species on Earth. Their top speed is 43 miles an hour, and they can run 30 miles an hour for 10 miles at a time, making them also one of the best long-distance runners in the animal kingdom. You can still, in some touristy spots, you can ride ostriches. I don't think people should. But I'll admit, as a kid, it was one of my first questions, right? Didn't you think that as a kid?
And that's a big nope from me, my friend. right. But you have that. It is neat though, because we talked about how, you know, their wings were sort of useless, I guess, or at least that would be the perception, I think. But that's not in fact the case. They don't fly in the air, but they sure do fly on the land. Like you said, they're the fastest long distance runners in the animal kingdom, and they actually use their wings as kind of like rudders, like a boat would use rudders, or like a plane would use, like, you know, those flaps. And it allows them to maneuver their bodies and kind of cut the air, like in Mario Kart when you like draft behind somebody, or when you do like a drift, you know. They're able to make these like very fast breaks and zigzagging patterns while they run, largely because they're using those wings to stay balanced and in control of their bodies.
Which leads us all to say you shouldn't try to fight an ostrich, and you definitely shouldn't try to outrun them. They will wax you. I do want to shout out, you know how WikiHow has all these weird articles? I found a WikiHow article called Three Ways to Survive an Ostrich Encounter or Attack. And just the images are hilarious.
What do you call a group of ostriches? A herd?
Yeah, I guess a herd. Let me see. Maybe a flock.
I believe. A flock.
Yeah.
Oh, like geese. Okay.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Well, my question for you was, if you ever came upon a flock of ostriches and all of them turn those weird little heads to you at the same time, you will know truly, my friends, the feeling of abject horror.
Almost as bad as seeing an ostrich mate.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I don't know if we're going to sleep tonight, guys. But, Ridiculous Historians, we hope you enjoyed this episode. You know we all love a good heist story, and we're so glad you tuned in with us today. Thanks, as always, to our super producer, Mr. Max Williams. Thanks to Casey Pegram. Thanks to Gabe Lousier.
Thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme. Eves Jeffcoats, Christopher Asiotis, always here in spirit. Jonathan Strickland, the Quister. You know what he would have maybe pointed out if we were here right now? Because he likes to point out pedantic little trivia facts. Did you know that a group of zebras is referred to collectively as a dazzle? And that is where the name for that weird type of military paint job that were at one point done on naval ships were referred to as dazzle camouflage. Because in a big group, the zebra stripes can actually create an optical illusion where it almost they appear to just to kind of vanish.
Nice. The more you know. Well, thanks for that, man. And thanks, of course, Noel. I feel like I need to send you a nice card or something, because I didn't realize initially how bird-centric this episode would be. But hopefully the heist made up for it.
Oh, yeah. It was fine. Those ostriches got what was coming to them. I'm kidding. I love all of God's creatures. They just creep me out. But they definitely deserve to live and not be plucked by, you know, weird South African poachers.
Ooh, crazy idea for ending the episode. Max, can we just, for the audio, can we just play the sound an ostrich makes?
Gross. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.